Chapter 5. Depression and Addiction. During this same turbulent few years of my life, while I was just starting to go through the NHS for gender dysphoria treatment, there were regular horror stories about people being refused trans treatments if they were depressed. I know plenty of cis people who have depression. Depression isn't some issue that's inextricably tied to being trans, making it impossible to treat dysphoria until generalised depression's gone. There's no real reason that being depressed should stop the NHS from treating your dysphoria, but I saw it happen time and time again. NHS waiting list times in the UK when I started trying to seek dysphoria treatment were several years long, and they've only gotten worse over time. Gender dysphoria is one of the few mental health areas currently where waiting lists to even get seen by someone, let alone receive any actual support or treatment, are commonly longer than 2 years. And if you're still mid-puberty when you start that waiting list, time is ticking. Every month spent waiting for treatment is another month of changes your body has made that you'll have to work to fight back against. Hearing that trans people who reported depression were made to get that sorted first, then had to rejoin a waiting list for treatment at the bottom, ensured that I never got treatment for my depression. I denied it existed to doctors because I was afraid of having to live through potentially 2 or more years before getting the help and treatment I needed. As a result of living for several years with untreated depression, I initially struggled severely with suicidal urges and suicide attempts that thankfully failed. However, I found a different source of support instead, one that didn't involve alerting medical professionals to my struggles. I began self-medicating my depression with addictive chemicals. Addiction. It took me until well into my 20s to properly come to terms with the fact that I'm prone to addiction. It wasn't a sudden revelation, but a slow, repeated awareness that got harder and harder to ignore. I'm not necessarily physically addicted to chemicals, but I'm prone to becoming addicted to short-term fixes for long-term mental health struggles. For a long time, it was generally assumed by the medical community that if someone has autism, they're considerably less likely than the general population to struggle with addiction. Many early studies into addiction and autism took place before Asperger's syndrome and other similar conditions were brought under the autism umbrella. And while yes, this did provide a set of data where individuals with autism had lower rates of alcohol and substance addiction, the data failed to correctly understand the causes for that data, made incorrect assumptions based on it, and had too narrow a scope of what constituted addiction. By focusing these early studies largely on the types of individuals with autism who require full-time care, the focus was on individuals who largely had less access to addictive substances like drugs, alcohol, or cigarettes. And the studies read that lack of access and the resulting lack in addiction as indicative of a predisposition to finding those chemicals less addictive than the general population. It's understandable why this assumption was made, because from the outside it would make a lot of sense within the framework of what medical professionals understood about autism as a condition. Most individuals with autism are generally rigid rule followers, and most addictive substances are forbidden, so it stood to reason that those with a brain predisposed to following rules wouldn't try or get addicted to forbidden substances. However, if we look at more recent studies focused on self-sufficient individuals on the autism spectrum, those capable of supporting themselves without long-term support, the results paint a very different picture. If you focus on the types of individual with autism that are in a position to experience peer pressure, to succumb to that peer pressure out of a desire for social connection, and who have access to addictive substances of their own accord, addiction rates are actually much higher than is average in the general population. One fairly recent Swedish study, which focused on people with autism who had average or above average IQ, found that those individuals experienced more than twice the statistical average rates of substance addiction. As an individual living with autism who has struggled with substance addiction, I can attest that there are a lot of similarities between how my brain feels when experiencing substance addiction and when experiencing bouts of autism-based addiction and compulsion. Autism, similar to other mental health conditions like ADHD, can cause many, but not all, sufferers to have counterindicative responses to specific drugs. Nobody's quite certain why it happens, or why it only affects some with the condition rather than all, but caffeine as a drug is a perfect example of something that often does the opposite of what it's meant to for individuals with autism. As you may have guessed, I am one of the individuals with autism who find the effects of caffeine counterindicative, meaning that rather than leaving me shaky and over-energized, I find it calms and relaxes me, providing me with a mental quiet I don't normally get to experience. I can't tell you why, but drugs that are meant to leave a person brimming with energy, bouncing off the walls, rushing around, often simply don't have that effect on me. I become focused, but more as a result of relaxing, tuning out a small portion of the normally overwhelming sensory information in the world around me and getting my brain to disconnect from the constant mental chatter that overwhelms my head. As a teenager, when I first started trying drinks with a high caffeine content, I was really caught off guard by the effect it had on me compared to my peers. It was the first time in my life I really got an opportunity to experience a mind where my autism symptoms, not that I initially knew that that's what they were, got a little more quiet. As someone whose Asperger's causes them to have a somewhat addictive personality, I ended up finding myself pretty cripplingly addicted to caffeine for a number of years. I would drink upwards of 10 cans of an energy drink a day, chugging them down like they were fruit juice. I would chug down the reserves of them that my parents had in the house for themselves, I would spend my pocket money on big 1-litre bottles, I even at times stole money from my parents to buy more caffeine drinks. I somewhat lacked the vocabulary at the time to explain to my parents that I was addicted, or quite why. It was just the first taste in my life of a brain less cluttered, less full of overwhelming, uncontrollable static. It was my first experience of getting to quiet down the mind, if only for a little while, and feel a little more on top of my senses. I have cut caffeine pretty much completely out of my life at this point, mainly because my consumption levels scared people close to me, but I still, as an adult, find it oddly calming to consume. It's not like it makes my autism symptoms go away completely, far from it, but it does offer a little control, calm and quiet in a world that often doesn't grant my brain that luxury. Addiction, however, has been a persistent issue in my life, even pushing aside caffeine. It was my first substance addiction in life, but it was not my first battle with addiction ever. My earliest experience with addiction was stimming, and my battle to keep that under control in order to avoid social ridicule. With both stimming and caffeine consumption, I had things I could do to reduce some of the noise and repetitive thought loops that so often fill up my mind from day to day. While they were both useful coping mechanisms, they ultimately led to negative outcomes in my life, be it getting into trouble for taking my parents' caffeine supply when I wasn't supposed to, or getting mocked and socially excluded by my peers. In both cases, I found myself just craving relief from a brain that was incessantly filled with static, constantly overwhelming bombardment, and the relief I was provided with often outweighed the negative consequences I knew would result. Trying to ignore this caused my head to shout at me like a broken record, unwilling to focus on anything else. Many of the same things could be said for my obsessive need to organise, my obsessive need to line things up, my obsessive need to plan. They were all ways to calm my mind that offered a calm and quiet that I craved. I was addicted to short-term respite from the chaos. It shouldn't come as a huge surprise that these experiences feel so similar, as they both affect largely the same areas of the brain. Studies have shown that individuals with autism often are compelled to engage in repetitive actions by the same brain regions that cause substance addicts to crave their vices, the section of the brain that automates actions and treats them as a necessary part of daily life that can't be ignored. What is vitally important to note about these addictions is they were all incredibly short-term solutions to a very long-term problem. I've spent my whole life living with a brain that doesn't behave like most, a brain that is never quite quiet and calm. Stimming and drinking caffeine both calm my brain and allow me to get by, but both only help alleviate the symptoms while they're acting on my system. If I stop stimming, or the caffeine leaves my system, I'm back to square one. This is why both are so addictive. They offer a moment of respite from the chaos, and returning to that lifetime of volume and static is exhausting and distressing enough to push me to return to my addictions. Day to day, I live with a brain that feels like it never stops or slows down. It's constantly trying to process every sense, no matter how small or unimportant, and trying to find the important information in a wave of static. It's constantly fixating on plans, making me check and recheck and write down and recheck times and locations and specifics of plans. It's constantly repeating the same phrases over and over in my head, screaming at me to focus on them. It's constantly fixated on unimportant topics, not letting me put them aside mentally and get on with what I need to do or want to do. It's screaming at me that foods have too many textures, or I'm reading social situations wrong, or I'm a burden and should just stay away from the world. It creates barriers between me and those around me that are hard to work around, and it makes every conversation a planned out exercise in social etiquette. Living with an autism spectrum condition is exhausting, and there are no known treatments to alleviate the symptoms. There's no prescribed medication available to offer me respite. I felt like my choices were to live this way every day, with no relief, or to find my own ways to quiet and calm my brain, if only for a short time. While it's no longer an issue in my life, I also struggled with alcohol addiction in my mid to late teen years. I would lie to my parents about where I was going and consume large amounts of alcohol on a beach while under the legal drinking age. I found that it dulled my senses by virtue of making me notice less across the board. I just generally ran a bit slower and didn't notice so much of the sensory information around me. It wasn't that I was filtering out the unimportant information and just focusing on the important stuff. It's that across the board I was taking in less information. I picture my brain as having three dials. One for important information, one for unimportant information, and one master dial for all information. Rather than alcohol turning down just the unimportant dial, it turned down the master dial. Everything was less intense. My brain's obsessive repetitive thoughts just slowed and lessened. On top of that, people consuming alcohol tend to act a little weird and unusual, which allowed me a little more room to fit in more easily, with less of my mind dedicated to worrying that I wasn't doing the right thing for the social situation. When drinking alcohol, everyone's a little weird. When consuming alcohol, I had something to blame my weird social behaviours on, an excuse to not worry if I acted strangely. A reason to not be so judged. Much like caffeine and stimming, my addiction to alcohol centred around its nature as a short-term fix for a long-term brain state. I could get drunk and experience relief from my symptoms, but as soon as I sobered up, I was back to square one, and the temptation was there to get drunk again, to reclaim that sense of respite. I kicked my addiction to alcohol around age 20, after a day where I had to admit to a friend I'd brought vodka in a water bottle to a social event, taking place in the morning, where it was clear nobody else would be drinking. I was forced to face the fact that I was relying on it as a crutch to manage social situations, rather than focusing on learning sober coping techniques to manage my symptoms in social situations. For a time, I cut out alcohol completely, before reintroducing it to my life under very strict conditions. No drinking alcohol alone by myself, no friendships where I don't feel comfortable socialising with them while sober, and no denying that I have drunk. If I break any of these self-imposed rules, I know I have a problem and will act accordingly. I might drink a couple of ciders in a field with my partner on a summer's day, or share a bottle of wine every few months over some board games with friends, but recognising the addiction allowed me to get it under control. Drugs, and why I started taking them. While I've spoken above about addiction to chemical substances that are generally not feared as addictive and are socially acceptable to dabble with, I'm now going to talk a little bit about my experience with substances that are more traditionally perceived as addictive. I have, as an adult, consumed MDMA. And while I unequivocally believe the experience was a net positive in my life, I had to wrestle with questions of addiction regarding the drug. MDMA, typically taken as a recreational party drug, is illegal in many countries of the world, including my own. While its primary use recreationally is to flood the brain with feel-good chemicals and create feelings of increased openness and empathy, clinical trials in the US suggest that it activates many of the same areas of the brain that function in non-standard ways in individuals with autism. From a brief appraisal, it's easy to see how a drug that induces feelings of positive empathy might be beneficial to individuals on the autism spectrum in a dry, abstract sense. For me, it was a world-changing experience, not just during the trip, but for months afterwards. The biggest thing I immediately noticed upon reaching the high brought on by a recreational MDMA dose was an instant quieting of the world. For someone who has lived years with sensory overload issues, I found myself able to walk through a crowded room, tuning out the background noise and not feel overwhelmed. I could smell an orange without feeling dizzy. I could see a crowd as individual people, not a chaotic mass of noise. I could eat foods with more than one texture. I could wear clothing with tags in the neck. I could mentally sort noises by importance and tune out the things I didn't need to focus on. For the first time ever, I was able to experience what a quiet world was like. I was able to sit down and just enjoy the sound of a world at rest. It wasn't a dulling of all of my sensory inputs, it was an increased ability to tune out the static and focus on the important, and that was something I'd never experienced before. It was turning down the static dial, but keeping the important information up full. While these aspects of respite from my autism symptoms were strongest during the high from the drug, they persisted after the high had ended, allowing me to enjoy a few days of a world finally quiet. They gave me the quiet space to reflect on my mind and to appreciate how much I have to push through in life. I was initially distressed by the realization I would have to go back to a world of sensory overload once the drug was out of my system, but a friend got me to see that conversely, until then, I'd lived my whole life not knowing I could ever get this kind of respite from sensory overload and other autistic spectrum symptoms. Rather than focus on it being sad the world would get loud again, I could be glad I now knew I could theoretically have moments of respite in my future. Now, this all sounds like the setup to a tale of addiction. An illegal wonder chemical that seems like it can solve all your problems with no drawbacks is a recipe for habitual behaviour and addiction. However, there were a few aspects of the drug itself that allowed me to avoid getting into a cycle of self-destructive, addictive behaviour with it. MDMA as a drug works by basically using up all of the brain's stores of chemicals like serotonin at once, meaning that repeated habitual usage dramatically diminishes the effectiveness of its results. It's a drug that, if abused by repeated usage, will just stop being effective no matter how much of it you consume. This acted as a remarkably strong failsafe to dissuade making use of it to get through day to day. If you take MDMA, let's say 3 or 4 days back to back, by the final day you'll find it's creating far less of a high with a far shorter duration and a far faster drop off to sobriety. You can physically feel a tolerance building up over just a couple of days. And that in and of itself makes it very easy to see its lack of suitability for use as a day-to-day coping tool. On top of that, the drug causes massively dilated pupils, a sign of drug usage which is incredibly tough to hide. As a result, there were very clear signs that would make my usage obvious and highlighted the need to be careful about when and how it was consumed. It's not the kind of thing you can subtly consume a little of to take the edge off a social situation, which makes it easier to avoid the alcohol mainstay of just one drink before I go out so I'm socially relaxed. Lastly, unlike stimming, alcohol, caffeine, or obsessive organisation, MDMA's effects didn't completely vanish when the chemical had left my system. Changes made by taking the drug once stayed around long term and provided long term relief to some of my symptoms. I didn't have to regularly take the drug in order to maintain many of the aspects of relief it provided me. Many of the effects of taking MDMA in my 20s stuck around for months and months, some even persisting to this day. First, my willingness to open up about how I feel, as well as starting conversations in general with people, increased dramatically. I expected that during the high itself, a desire to talk to everyone and make everyone my new best friend. I did not expect a long-term increase in ability to communicate with others. I grew up, like many people with autism, somewhat locked in my own head. I went years refusing to open up to my own family in spite of their actively supportive nature, and tried to carry any issues in life on my own shoulders. I knew how overwhelming I found these problems, and I expected them to stress my family in the same way. They're neurotypical, so probably not. I went well into my adulthood not being proactively communicative with those I grew up with, even when I actively needed help. In the long stretch of time since taking MDMA, I've found myself going out of my way to see how my family's doing. I've gone out of my way to start small talk conversations with them, and not ones pre-planned with a flowchart. I've gone to my parents with things that worry me and asked for advice, as adults I know I can trust and be open with. I started really communicating with them in a meaningful way. I've started going out to social events in crowded venues completely sober and not being afraid to talk to new people. I now start conversations with people I barely know and make long-term friends, something I never felt comfortable doing before. I've been able to shut out the mentally addictive pull of obsessively refreshing social media, which has freed up so much of my head in any given day. I can now eat some foods with multiple textures, something I was never able to do before. I can eat pineapple, cucumber, allergic yellow peppers, celery, dried mango, grapes, and a whole host of other foods that previously just made me gag. And lastly, I realised how thankful I am to be autistic, at least in one area of my life. I realised how terrifyingly quiet the world actually is as a result of taking MDMA, and how much of my willingness to be alone is thanks to living with autism. The world itself is quiet, and that quiet can be terrifying to experience alone. Me? I live in a world where there's always low-level sounds, senses blasted, a lot happening. When you live life in static, it's hard to ever feel isolated and alone. I've enjoyed being able to get respite from autism when I have the company to share that respite with, but I wouldn't want to be neurotypical when alone. It just seems so incredibly lonely living in a world not filled with that static. It's not a drug I would ever want to consume alone, because a world without the constant static of autism is actually terribly isolating. It's not a world I would feel compelled to live in every day of my life. However, as much as I may have just spent a lot of words waffling on about how great MDMA is, I can't deny I'm addicted to it. I am a drug addict still, to this day, as a result of having taken an MDMA. Sure, I'm not the scary kind of drug addict. I'm not taking increasingly large amounts of drugs and putting myself at risk of a fatal overdose, nor am I facing any financial hardship as a result of substance usage, but I'm still a drug addict. Like, I may not take MDMA on a daily basis, but I sure as hell think about doing so daily. Every day at some point in the day, a small part of me thinks about doing MDMA. I can rationally tell myself it's not a good idea, that I shouldn't because I'm at work or it'll be noticeable, or because taking it alone is a telltale sign of addiction, but the thought is there every day of my life, and it does take willpower to ignore. MDMA has made some positive long-term changes to my brain and has made living with autism undeniably easier in my day-to-day life. But the sheer strength of its autism relief properties, when actually mid-high, is incredibly powerful and something tough to resist the allure of. Multiple times in my life, I've faced issues of substance addiction, as have many of my friends with autism. While many substances out there, both legal and not, are able to dampen the symptoms of autism, it's easy to crave that period of relief. And that craving of relief can become addiction with relative ease. So many of the coping mechanisms available to autistic individuals are frowned upon by society, or take huge amounts of energy to maintain, and the idea of a quick fix so that you never have to deal with the day-to-day struggle of autism can be incredibly appealing. In terms of lowering addiction rates in people with autism, we need to tackle the problem from several different directions. I feel that stigmatization of activities like stimming needs to be fought so that non-chemical coping mechanisms are not something that people are afraid to explore. However, on top of that, we need to support proper research into autism symptoms and medication options that can offer relief and respite to those who want it, without having to resort to inebriants. There are clearly chemicals out there that can affect a brain with autism, albeit with side effects, and until we find a treatment that can help calm those symptoms when needed, people are going to regularly turn to illegal or context-inappropriate, potentially addictive ways of self-medicating the days where their symptoms are just too much to bear. Lastly, we need understanding and compassion for individuals with autism who struggle with issues of addiction. If people could look at people with autism who use substances like MDMA or alcohol to manage their symptoms from time to time, understand that they're trying to find respite from a condition that never switches off and has no official treatment options, and sympathise with the difficulty of that situation, it would make it easier to have honest conversations about the things that drive that addiction and how to safely walk the line between occasional respite and life-impacting addiction. I'm lucky in that I'm a drug addict whose addiction is under control. I think about illegal drugs on a daily basis, but I certainly don't act on that daily urge to consume Class A drugs. I don't use drugs alone, I don't use drugs to a financially detrimental extent, and I don't use them in amounts that risk death by overdose. Still, I'm an addict, and I can't deny that fact. I'm someone living with a brain that's never quiet, living with a condition with no official medication available to treat it, and until we have a proper conversation about addiction rates in people with autism spectrum conditions, people like me will continue to live, trying to balance their addictions with the urge to find relief from an overwhelming lifelong medical condition.